FM Houston. We have an interesting show tonight. It is not open forum because I have a guest, but it will be call-in. My guest tonight is Sam Houston. That is his real name and not something that he simply changed it to in order to run. He is the Democratic nominee for Attorney General of the state of Texas. His Republican candidate is as yet unknown because they're in a runoff, but when we know who he will be running against, I will invite them on the show as well. Sam Houston is a practicing Texas attorney with 26 years of experience. He is entering the Attorney General's office if he is elected. He's running for it with almost twice the actual experience practicing law than did Greg Abbott, the current Attorney General. He also brings a lifetime of business knowledge spanning from acting as a partner in his own successful law firm, going back to his early years participating in the family's small business. Sam lives in Houston with his wife, Jantha, and their two children, Audrey and Donnie. Thank you so much for being here tonight, Sam. So how are you doing? You just came good from the Spring Branch Democratic Club meeting.
I did, Mike. Thanks for having me tonight. I appreciate the chance to talk to people.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. We will be taking questions from the audience. We're going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes, but let me give out the phone number. It's going to be 713-526-5738, 723-526-KPFT. One of the things that you say is the reason that you're running is to shift the focus of the Attorney General's office back to law and representation of the interest of Texans and the state of Texas rather than using the office as a political enforcement tool, a political agenda tool, and possibly a career-making tool. So why don't you tell us a little about your motivations in that area?
And sure, and I mean, in most political campaigns, that would almost be a throwout term. People always say that. But the funny thing about this race at this time is it's absolutely true. I am not a current office holder, which I guess people would maybe try to use against me. I think it's a plus. The Attorney General's office is a very misunderstood, I think, election and also office. It's immensely important to everyday lives of everyday Texans, and a lot of people can't say, you know, what they do. But what's happened is, probably because of the Republican domination of our statewide politics, is that the office has been really used. First it was Senator Cornyn, who sat in the Attorney General's office, and now it's General Abbott, who's running for governor. So you've got two people who have used it for a stepping stone to go from, you know, one office to another. And the problem has been is that while they're in the office, it's been used more to further their own political interests, particularly what's happened over the last 10 years. My concern has been that the office and a lot of the lawsuits and the rhetoric that comes out of the office tends to be more featured on what helps the Republican Party and what helps the current Attorney General go to the next step, as opposed to what's better for Texans.
Now, we were talking before we went on the air, a story that I heard when I was accidentally listening to 700 AM. Well, I mean, you know, I changed my battery in my car, and I had to erase all of my radio stations, so now I have to go through them all over again. It's a placeholder. But they were talking about some comments that Greg Abbott made related to the Bureau of Land Management and some property. The details are still a little fuzzy, and the statement made by Greg Abbott doesn't help to clarify it much. But apparently he's looking to pick a fight with the federal government over what might be private land that perhaps is going to be claimed by the Bureau of Land Management that we're not sure actually is going to be an issue, but he's already ready to sue.
Right, and, you know, you asked me about it, and, again, I read the story today, and I can tell you this. My suspicions are high because I don't know that there's been a land grab by the federal government, and even though I was reading some of the headlines, it says, you know, General Abbott says, come and take it. They're wrecking it back to the flag and the war. And when you read it, though, and the devil's always in the details, I don't know that there's been a land grab. Historically, there's been federal land along riverbeds. I think the Bureau of Land Management may or may not be. I don't know. I haven't seen their statement yet. But doing a study about what would be done for the best environmental use of the land, whatever. And so, again, all of a sudden, though, on the heels of what's going on out in Nevada with the rancher Bundy, all of a sudden you hear, you know, General Abbott, who's running for governor, making a big deal and appealing to, and if you go to the blogs or the websites, all the more the right-leaning oriented ones are immediately saying this is, you know, President Obama is attempting to go grab Texas land. I mean, it's the rhetoric is high. And what's even more disconcerting, and again, this is part of what I guess bothers me, is that you can go to the Office of Attorney General public website, which is really supposed to be about the day-to-day business of, you know, handling child support, and there it is, the story about Greg Abbott, you know, taking on the federal government. That's the precise kind of thing that needs to stop. It's the precise kind of things of why I'm running. You know, and I'll tell you, I don't want to just sound like I'm ranting and raving because I'm not, but it's the exact...
They've heard me rant and rave. There's a difference.
I don't. You know, I'm supposed to be lawyerly because I am. I am a lawyer, but I'm a lifetime lawyer. Look, I've litigated more than any of the people that are running for the office. I represented countless been involved in lawsuits. I know about lawsuits, about how to work and run a regular law office, and that's not what's being done. Best example, here it is. This is Greg Abbott. Instead of working with the federal government and keeping things behind the line, if there is a dispute about Red River borders, what does he do? He fires a shot across the bow and instantly accuses them of all kind of misdeeds. You know, this is the same office that has 27 lawsuits currently, or I don't know, maybe some of them have settled. It's 27 lawsuits against the federal government. It happens that I think almost there were three during the George Bush presidency, and now there's 27. It's the attorney general who's part of his rhetoric.
Makes George W. Bush look liberal now, doesn't
right,
it? It's amazing.
Right.
Every Republican president makes the former one look like a liberal by comparison.
Mm. You know, but a part aside, it's not about conservative, liberal. It's about managing the office efficiently. And I can tell you the last thing a real lawyer does in taking on is brag about its lawsuit. A real lawyer, even the most, you know, the lawyers that I deal with every day, a lawsuit should be a last resort. And this attorney general and the people that are running for it all brag about, you know, I get up every morning and I sue Obama and I go to the office and I sue Obama. Look, and that is, you know, look, whether you do or don't agree
get a
with
cup
the
of
federal
my morning
government,
lawsuit.
Right. You know, it's the party that's supposed to be about lawsuit reform, and their number one campaign promise is I'm going to sue our own government. Well,
it's
that's
a cognitive
just, that's
dissonance
not good
thing.
Government. That's not a good way to run the office.
Let me ask you, I think, first a fundamental question. Rachel Maddow did an interesting discussion last night about the role of lawyers in American jurisprudence, that it's not necessarily about whether you agree with the position of your client or whether you believe in the innocence of your client. It's about every position, every client deserving a decent defense, a decent advocate for their situation. The state attorney general is supposed to be the advocate for the state of Texas and the people of Texas. So I imagine there are times when an attorney general, a lawyerly attorney general who approaches the job from a lawyerly perspective, that you must defend that which you are assigned to defend, sometimes you have to go to court and defend things that you don't agree with because you are the Attorney General for the state of Texas. So I guess to start with a really narrow description, what is the role of the state Attorney General, and how does the person make the difference in terms of how that is implemented when you talk about the state having a right to its advocate, the citizens having a right to their advocate, maybe occasionally the judgment calls that an attorney general makes? Where do the lines get drawn there, and where does the person make the difference?
Well, you know, I've studied politics for a long time. I think the person defines the role in every office. Bob Bullock defined the role of lieutenant governor differently than it had ever been done in Texas. But particularly in the attorney general's office, the character, the attitude, the experience of the attorney general does make a difference, a huge difference. Because, yes, in a generic sense, and it is true, the attorney general, you are the attorney for the state of Texas. It's your obligation to defend the state if they're sued from other citizens, federal government, potentially the job to defend if there's the Constitution and the legislation. I know when you look at it historically, General Maddox always had, I think there were some issues and difficulties on defending the state in writ of habeas corpus on death penalty cases. Lots of varied jobs. But, you know, the way and the resources you put into certain issues do define the office. And again, and the example I'm giving and the most concrete I can give that I tell people, the resources and the time that it seems to have been expent by the Republican and basically is being offered in the future seems to be that a lot of resources and time and money is being spent on quarreling over 10th Amendment issues. It's, you know, the number one thing on my opponent's website. And that is basically suing the federal government or Macy's states' rights versus federal rights.
Which is something we thought we'd settled 150 years
ago. It should have been. But instead of the Consumer Protection Division, which was a bigger focus on some of the previous attorney general's offices, there are cases that I really do think, and we've talked about it, I've written about it, that where the attorney general, even though you have an obligation to defend the state, then you can make settlements and make recommendations, write opinions.
Amicus briefs.
Choose which amicus briefs to enter into. And more importantly, when legislation is being proposed, if asked, or even if you wish to volunteer in some cases, the attorney general can issue opinions, which influences policy. You know, the education lawsuit's a good example right now.
Is it possible for the interests of the state of Texas and the interests of the citizens of Texas to be legally in opposition where the attorney general then has to take a side, or from a legal perspective, is that not possible?
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, you could have an individual suing the state of Texas. I mean, the everyday example, I mean, I hope I'm understanding your question. You know, the attorney general's office defends state institutions when they're sued for tort action. So, you know, there could be a accident and the office of attorney general is defending the state. You, as a taxpayer, you could be suing, you know, and again, why you bring a lawsuit against the state. But I hear your question, so I'm going to answer a different question.
Okay.
The attorney general has to decide what is the interest of the state of Texas. Another good example is the lawsuits against the Environmental Protection Agency, which there's a legion of them, where the attorney general's office has taken a pretty strong stance that, you know, emissions, the federal government or the EPA doesn't have the authority, and I'm not going to get into the constitutional issues,
sure,
but there's tons of issues and cases against the EPA. Well, Mr. Abbott will say, I'm defending the state of Texas. When in fact, you know, if you look at a lot of these, could it be a very select few that are benefiting from these lawsuits, when in fact a number of Texans are factually being harmed by hampering the EPA's ability to regulate certain industries? And has that slowed down the permitting process to even hurt other businesses? So you have to define what is the interest of the state of Texas, and that's why the job and the role is important.
The state of Texas, and I guess through the Attorney General primarily, has been fighting pollution rules and regulations and laws for many, many, many years. I think almost as long as I've lived here, which is 1977. So I think that's a really interesting topic to bring up in terms of the interests of the state of Texas and the institutions of Texas as they perceive it to defend their state's rights or to defend their right to regulate or not regulate as they wish versus the impact on the individual Texan on not being sure of the quality of their water, of not being able to control the quality of their air. They have to breathe, they have no choice, and yet the government may be at odds with their interest in the quality of that air that they're forced to breathe. So that's a place where the Attorney General might be able to make choices or make a difference?
Yes. I mean, look, the Attorney General's office, again, the Attorney General sits as an ex officio of most of the heads. The Attorney General's office issues opinions. If a particular, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, when they're sued or different lawsuits, the Attorney General's office would handle those types of situations generally. I saw there was an article today, just again on a more broad, about the tragedy of West. You know, too little regulation, too little oversight.
We can talk about that.
And, you know, and really there was nothing there, both federally or at the state level, to prevent that accident. And, again, everybody, I don't think anybody in the Democratic Party, the Republican Party tends to brand us as that we all want all these regulations. You know, we don't want regulations, but regulations are just laws. And there are certain regulations that do serve a purpose. So the difference I have with what the rhetoric, at least on the Republican Party, and again, this goes to just not only being an attorney general, but a citizen, is that, yeah, I want as little regulations and allow business to go forward, but you have to have rules, and you have to have laws, and you have to have things to follow. And for their side to say, you know, we're going to abolish all of them is just unrealistic. And that's what this election is going to be about.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. We will take phone calls. You can call in and ask Sam Houston any questions you would like to relating to the topic of his run for Attorney General. Sam is the Democratic nominee for Attorney General for the state of Texas. Currently, he does not have an actual Republican opponent because they're in a runoff. And actually, by the way, let me say, there are two runoff elections coming up in Texas. There's a special, what they call a special election in SD4, Senatorial District 4, on May 10th. And because the best way to save money, administrative costs, and generate turnout is to then have another election on May 27th, which is considered to be the actual Democratic and Republican primary runoff election, because splitting them up is cost-effective and generates turnout. But you will be able to early vote. You can go, if you're in Harris County, you can go to harrisvotes.org, I think it is. Or if worst comes to worst, if you don't know exactly where to go or what site to visit, you can go to the Texas Secretary of State's office, and generally they can refer you to all kinds of election information. I thought we were going to have a phone call, but apparently not. Okay, so just want to say we will take phone calls, 713-526-5738. Sam Houston, Democratic nominee for Attorney General for the state of Texas, running in the election this November. On your website, you have a number of positions that you touch upon. One is taking the politics out of the position. I think we've discussed that.
Right.
The other is the economy. Now, the economy and the Attorney General are not two things that most people think go together. You think of the Attorney General, laws, lawsuits, regulations, enforcing Texas law. How does the economy get involved with the position of Attorney General, jobs and the economy?
Well, again, the Attorney General's office impacts at least the way the different regulatory agencies are run, the oversight that's given to those agencies.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. The position, you know, the Attorney General takes on certain legislation, for example, you know, equal wage laws. The position the Attorney General takes, I gave a great example a minute ago. There was a good article I read a while back, talking about, again, this issue of the EPA lawsuits and the position that Texas has taken through the Attorney General's office that has actually slowed down the permit process, because Texas takes the position that the EPA can't set these emission standards. And that's even slowed down the permit process for the refineries or for industry that even wants to move forward, because you can't move forward. The position that the Attorney General's office would take that would, again, would award people that comply with laws and punish the wrongdoers. All of these attitudes, it's the same thing I've always said. Lawyers and lawsuits can be good for business or they can be bad for business. And lawyers and lawsuits in the highest level of the office can certainly affect the economy just because of the position and the attitude you take on the lawsuit and the positions with the regulatory agency.
You know, you made an interesting point about indeterminate decisions hampering business. It's not even a matter of a good regulation or a bad regulation. It's an indeterminate regulation. Back in 2010, I think it was, when the Republicans were running in the off-year election, the congressional elections, one of the arguments that they were making was to end the uncertainty, that there was just so much uncertainty with the Obama administration and regulations, and their whole argument was, we're going to end the uncertainty. And of course, what they've done is they've enhanced the uncertainty with all the regulation, all the laws, or not laws, all the bills that have passed in the House that have no chance of passing the Senate or being signed by the president, the obstruction, the obfuscation. And when you talk about the impact on jobs and the economy that can be touched upon by the Attorney General, you're talking about ending the uncertainty. There's either going to be a regulation or there isn't going to be a regulation, or there's going to be a good reason why the Attorney General is getting involved in the formation or implementation of that regulation.
Right. Policy is going to be set for the good, not because of some political expediency, not to make the far right happy, not to make a certain sector happy. The policy is going to be set for the good of business, not political and not politicized. That's the real problem, I can tell you, on everything that's going on right now.
Okay. I'd like to take the first caller. John from Conroe, you're on the air with Sam Houston and Mike Honig on ThinkWing. So what's on your mind tonight? Hello, John.
Every Yankee Exxon, I'm from Chicago originally. When they talk about Texas succeeding, do I understand it correctly where Texas would have to be broken up into several sections they were to succeed?
You're not saying succeeding. You're saying seceding
to leave the union,
leave the United States.
Right.
Okay. And your question is, what would they have to be? What, broken up?
Yes. Yes. That was my understanding of an article I read quite a while back when Perry was saying, yeah, maybe we should do that.
Well, look, I haven't studied that because Texas is not going to secede from the United States.
Well, I understand that, but I was just wondering if it was a foolishness or not.
Well, it is. I mean, what any talk about Texas seceding, or quite frankly, the quieter talk, which I've been talking about, it Texas being at war with the United States is foolishness, in my opinion. And the current office holders aren't that far from the people who say Texas can secede, or the people who are out there spending silver dollars saying we're the Republic of Texas and this coin is done. All of that is the same. I don't know the process of what it would take for Texas to leave, other than there would be a big battle and we're not going to do it.
Yeah, oh, I understand that. But as I said, my main question...
Hello?
...foolishness of it in the first place. But I was trying to find out if I sort of understood the intricacies more than the Texans that are born and bred Texans that are saying, yeah, we can just leave and... You know, we're our own country now.
Well,
that's all.
If I may offer my understanding, is when Texas joined the Union under the Treaty of Session, I think in like 1848 or thereabouts, because they were such a large piece of territory, each side had concerns. The United States was concerned that they would be too dominant, and Texas was concerned that they wouldn't be able to obtain proportional power. So
okay.
I believe in the Treaty of Session there was a provision which has come to be called splithood, where Texas could divide itself up into as many as five different states, each one with its own two senators. So if Texas, now this is prior to the Civil War when that treaty was in force, that Texas could then split itself up into as many as five states, giving it up to 10 senators. Of course, the congressional representation in the House wouldn't change, but that would give them more proportional, in their view, representation. However, in order to do that, you know, you'd have to have the state legislature agreeing to do that, and
right. It
just never happened.
Prior
to the Civil War, there was some uncertainty as to whether states had the right to secede, and I think it was maybe the 16th Amendment that settled that, mm-hmm. that once you join the Union, it's a one-way street. You can call it the equivalent of a Roach Motel if you want to be unflattering. But, you know, you can. Some people might. But I think that the key piece of information here is that when Texas rejoined the Union after the Civil War, it was not under the terms of the Treaty of Session. It was under the rules set by the U.S. government for the readmission of former Confederate states. So that treaty should no longer be in force, and Texans who keep citing it really don't understand the historical curve. That's my understanding.
Well, Mike, okay. You know more about it than me. I'll be honest with you. I am running for office. I have not studied secession or how the state would secede.
I just have this endless curiosity.
There you go.
Well, once again, you have a really intelligent show. Mr. Houston, thank you for being on it. And once again, you made me giggle a little.
Well, thank you so much. I like doing that.
Have a good evening,
have
gentlemen.
Have a good night. Okay, I have Lee from Cyprus on the line. How you doing tonight, Lee? You're on with Sam Houston and myself.
Well, for both of you, you're close on your issues on secession.
Okay.
Texas Constitution allows for secession at any time, except the Texans got stupid a while back. I think within, the last 7 to 10 years, and they put a new Constitution up, and they left that out of it. So they no longer have the right to secede because the Texas Constitution overrode and was law that went up against the U.S. treaties, and Texas did have the right to secede until they ratified the new Constitution.
I'm not a lawyer, but I would probably disagree with that interpretation.
Well, you can disagree with it, but that's the fact of the matter, and our good hair governor is really out of touch. So thank you, gentlemen, for being there, and by the way, Sam's got my support.
Well,
have a
thank
good
you.
Night.
Okay, so...
Bye.
We've now heard enough.
Right.
Thank you so much,
Thanks
Lee.
Thanks for calling.
We have open lines. The phone number here is 713-526-5738, otherwise known as 713-526-KPFT. My guest is Sam Houston, the Democratic nominee for Attorney General of the state of Texas, and he will be on the general election ballot in November. We're still waiting to find out who his Republican opponent will be. And we're taking callers to ask questions directly of Sam, and we'd love to hear from you, 713-526-5738. And I guess it's also time for the station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT FM Houston 90.1. Getting back to jobs and the economy, you touched earlier upon the town of West Texas. And, boy, that is a confusingly named town because it could be in East Texas. Anyway, West Texas, this catastrophe with the fertilizer plant explosion, in a state where regulation is considered to be almost a four-letter word, until people die.
Right.
And then it's like, why did that happen? Why wasn't something done? I think it's kind of interesting that in the state of Texas, I think in most other states in the union, there would have been an enormous uproar about where was the government to prevent this. And there was a little of that, but I have to say, I wouldn't say that it was a groundswell of outrage in Texas about why this thing had not been inspected recently, had not been entirely candid on the reports they had filed about what was on the premises. And yet, you know, you haven't had any resignations, you haven't had any indictments. It's just kind of gone away.
Right, you know, and at least my understanding, and this is from the news sources, and what I've heard is that the owner, it was greatly underinsured, so the victims aren't going to probably have much redress. And, you know, again, it's a kind of a philosophical point, but you bring it up, and I bet you do a lot of philosophical.
I do. I have way too much time to think.
You know, I've been accused of that. But, look, here's the deal. I've always said this. Regulations are kind of like lawsuits. You know, people hate lawsuits until something happens to them, and then they're always asking me, why can't we sue, you know, or this. And I always say this, you know, in commerce and in any free society, there has to be rules. And my disagreement with the Republican Party has always been they don't want regulations, they don't want lawsuits. Well, then, you know, you have no regulations, and the tort system that doesn't seem to deter people because it's non-existent. You know what happens? Things like West. That's what happens. There are a lot of very good, reputable businesses that do play by the rules. But you know what? There's some that don't. And so the philosophy of myself and I think the party and the ticket, in fact, on this next election – differs from the Republican in that is that we do believe in government that does have limitations and that the society that does set limitations on business to prevent things like West happening where people are killed and injured, which they shouldn't be killed or injured at all, but then when and if that does happen, that there's redress, because that's just the way it should be. That's what's fair.
I see. There's a term that I developed a few years ago, what I call right regulating. You can have over-regulating, under-regulating, and then I think that there is right regulating.
Right.
I think that you made a point just a moment ago that regulation is really just a rule or a law. It's something everybody subscribes to. It's a way of knowing that when you're on a city street, your speed limit is 25 or 30 or 40 miles an hour. When you're on the highway, the speed limit is 65. But the low end, there's actually a minimum speed limit on most highways of maybe 45 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So you can't go faster, you can't go slower, according to the rule, the regulation, the traffic law.
Sure.
I kind of see right regulation as a place where you're creating a floor below which companies don't go. They can't make anything less safe than the floor. They can't make anything less durable than the floor. If you're doing something like a medical insurance policy, you can't offer less than the floor. So people know that this is the minimum, and companies can offer better, and they can base their pricing and their marketing on value added, based on better features, better quality, better life expectancy of their product, and that's their choice. They can decide where they want to be on the market. But the regulation says everybody is on the same level playing field. Nobody can take advantage through a race to the bottom. Or as H. Ross Perot once said, that giant sucking sound you'll hear is the jobs. He thought it was going to be Mexico. It turns out to be China.
Right.
Attorney generals get involved in those kinds of things through certain kinds of discretion, yes?
They do. Opinions and the rulemaking and when they challenge it, again, the attorney general's office, again, I keep going back to it, but the primary role is suing the federal government on whether or not they had the authority to make certain regulations.
And the discretion on whether or not to
exactly.
do that.
Exactly. And questioning those. And you're absolutely right about minimum regulations. You talk about OSHA regulations, fair labor regulations.
Should people be endangered to do
right.
their jobs?
Yes. You know, people will say, and I'll talk to neighbors about things sometimes, and it's always, you know, that gum EPA or that OSHA or whatever. And you'd ask them, say, well, okay, let's assume, are you saying abolish all of them? No. Are you saying get rid of it where back in the 70s all these companies were dumping mercury in the water pool, so you're saying we should have no, just, you know, get rid of those? Well, no, we need those. Well, tell me which regulation.
Whose ox gets gored.
Yeah, and they usually can't tell you. And that's because, you know, again, I'm not in favor of overregulating, but there are times, and I just keep saying it, that rulemaking and laws and government are important, and it makes a difference, and it is what is going to be about, what a lot of this campaign is going to be about.
I actually have come to the conclusion that it's fair to say that while profit is private, pollution is public.
That's pretty good.
And until a better balance is struck between the responsibilities of private profit and the risks of public pollution, I think that there's still some work to do on the regulatory front.
Look, and rampant pollution is non-profitable in the long run. It's long run versus short run a lot of times.
Well, it's not profitable if you're going to make them pay to clean it up. Right. If you're not going to make them pay to clean it up, it's extremely profitable.
But eventually somebody has to clean it up. So,
The public. The taxpayer, the right. average Texan, someone else.
Right. Someone made money in the short run, and in the long run we all pay.
Right. We have a caller, and by the way, open lines, 713-526-5738. Larry from Houston, you're on the air with Sam Houston and myself. How are you doing tonight?
Doing all right. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
My background is in transportation, chemicals, consulting. I've been in the industry for about 35 years. Unfortunately, there are too many situations like West Texas, and if you study our history, it even goes back to the incident in Texas City, to where that doing the wrong thing by untrained people resulted in multiple deaths, major property damage. The
power of a small nuclear bomb in Texas City.
Yeah, the incident in Texas City nearly wiped Texas City off the map. The incident in West came pretty close to taking West off the map.
Let's just touch really quickly so that people not familiar know. I think it was in 1946. This was after the Second World War. There were ships taking on fertilizer.
Yes.
And somebody maybe lit a cigarette where they shouldn't have or something like that, and there was a chain reaction. And literally, I think that the total explosive power was something like, I don't know, a 10 or 20 kiloton bomb.
Yeah,
and
thousands of people died. It blew out windows in Houston.
Yeah, it was just an amazingly powerful explosion. And again, regulation.
West was the same thing, just on a smaller scale.
Which is amazing to contemplate, a smaller scale.
The problem that I see, and as I said, I'm a consultant in the industry, and I deal with a lot of companies that are not, as we say, towing the line. And you go in and you do audits and you tell them this is what you need to do, this is what you need to fix. We were hired as consultants on the value jet crash. And again, same thing, not having properly trained employees to deal with products. The reports that I've seen on West is that the local volunteer fire department had not had the proper chemical fire safety training. Not that that's any shortfall of the fire department, it's just that the community was not able to raise the funds for them to go through the appropriate school. Or unwilling. More than likely, small towns do have a tendency to support their volunteer fire department. In big towns like Houston, you pay taxes, and then those taxes go so that Houston has its hazmat teams, that they have special firefighters that go through what's called HAZWOPER training, which typically is a minimum 40-hour class, and they have to go through it every year. The city of Houston does have inspectors that go around and check companies to make sure that they are within the standards. And even with that, there are still a lot of places here in Houston that I've been to that I get in my vehicle and I call my customer and I tell them, first, you need to get your stuff out of this building, and second, I will not work on this site.
So, Larry, how do you feel like a different attorney general might make a difference in that kind of experience?
Well, it depends on whether he's going into the office to make a difference or if he's going into the office to be a politician.
Well, of course, Sam is saying he's going into the office to make a difference, so let's work on that presumption.
Okay, if he's going in that assumption, he's got my vote. I've got friends. Well, let me correct it. I have someone that I know that has been in politics in Texas in Harris County for many, many, many years. And we went to church together when I was a young man. I'm 62 now, so I've been banging around Houston for a long time. When my friend/associate first got into politics, he had the golden boy attitude of, I'm going to go in and make a difference. Well, he's still in politics, and as far as I can see, he hasn't made a difference. And even though he's someone that I know, I don't vote for him.
Well, nothing is as easy as it looks, and I suppose the hand of progress moves slowly.
That's what I'm saying with my job. I'll have companies hire me to come in and do consulting work, and a lot of times when I give them my final report on the audit, they're not real happy.
Because
I'm very adamant about the safety issue.
And safety costs money.
If the company had done what they were supposed to in West, they would not have had that much product on the site at one time.
I appreciate your bringing it back around to that, because that is the point. Thank you so much for calling, Larry. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I enjoy the show.
Thank you
so
much. You too.
Thank you, Larry.
We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. My guest tonight is Democratic Attorney General nominee Sam Houston. He'll be in the general election on the ballot in November.
Larry said something I just want to
touch
on, and we'll get back to West in a minute. But he is right. I think a lot of people do go into politics kind of with the dewy-eyed thinking, you know, that we can change.
Whichever side of the divide they're on, most of these people go into politics to do good as they see it.
Yeah, and I think people have that. And, you know, and look, what I tell everybody, this will be the second time I've run statewide, so I'm not a novice at this. But I actually, you know, and I have a pretty successful law practice. This isn't something I'm doing because I need a job. You know, family's all here in Houston.
Well, this isn't something I'm doing because I need a job either. I don't get paid for it.
Yeah, right. But the deal is here, and this is kind of one of the things that why we run. I think, and this is why this election is so important, that the system works better when all parties are at the table, when you have both sides
and in
represented
good faith.
And in good faith.
Even if they disagree, but in good
no
faith.
No question. And I think that's the change we have seen in our system, is that they're so polarized, they don't even talk. And in Texas, the problem we've had, and this is one of the reasons I've continued to run, is that, you know, our party, the Democratic Party, has been shoved back down, and we haven't won a statewide election in so long. And it's the Republican dominance now that just one side is being heard. And it's the far industry side, the Tea Party side now. It is that voice that runs their primaries. And it's that voice then, the far right of that party, that's going to run their elections. And then if their elections run the statewide, then you've got a very small minority voice basically electing our decision makers in the state. And until we elect and everybody comes out, again, this is a pitch for me because that's why I'm on this station,
right.
Is that until we elect a Democrat statewide, that's not going to change.
That brings up for me 2 points. One is a catchphrase I like. I didn't make this one up. But 99, if the 99% voted, the 1% wouldn't matter. That's a sticker that I got from making a contribution.
Think about that.
If
okay,
the 99% voted, the 1% wouldn't matter.
Hmm.
Another consideration, and we're going to talk, I think, about this. This is a nice segue into voting rights.
Right.
Another thing that I've considered is that, you know, there is always this discussion, and I've changed my mind on this over the years, about whether people should vote if they're ignorant of the issues and ignorant of the candidates. And there was a time when I was younger that I felt very, very strongly that if somebody was not paying attention, they probably shouldn't vote. They should leave the voting to the people that, quote, know what they're doing, unquote. What I have seen, though, over the last maybe 20 years is increasingly it's motivated minorities that then control the outcome of elections when the non-voting majority, you know, it's funny, but we'll maybe use the term the silent majority, the Democratic silent majority or Democratic leaning, because they don't show up at the polls, they end up either not having a voice, well, they don't have a voice because they didn't show up at the polls, but they also end up not having representation for their points of view because it becomes such a lopsided victory. You know, I'm not an enormous fan of light rail as it was conceived in Houston. It's worth noting that it was put on the ballot year after year after year, and finally, I guess you had some ballot fatigue, and it was finally approved by a majority of 10% of the voters. So a multi-billion-dollar, multi-decade plan that was going to change the face of Houston for good or ill a majority of 10% of the voters decided to do that. So I have come to the conclusion that voter participation, more voter participation, better voter participation, hopefully informed voter participation, but at the very least getting the massive numbers so that you get a better statistical representation of people's viewpoints rather than let a motivated minority control the political and economic direction of a state or a city or whatever. Attorney General starts to have a lot of impact on things like voter rights, voter rules. Would you like to talk to that?
Absolutely. It's a big issue. You were being a little more philosophical than I'm going to be, though, I like philosophical. But to me, yes, you know, I wish there was more voter participation. I absolutely agree with you that it's a good thing if more people are informed. But everybody needs the right to vote. It is mandatory.
They don't need it. They're entitled to it. That's why it's called a right.
It's being taken away. And what a big disagreement I've had with the past Attorney General's office and the people that are running for Attorney General is all this notion of all this voter fraud that then
allegedly
justifies IDs or it justifies further barriers to voting. Look, the voter ID bill, with most people, when you talk to them about it, you know, it's currently under litigation. The Attorney General's office is defending the state on that. The Attorney General, Greg Abbott, you know, sat on the board, the redistricting board, that gerrymandered districts in an unconstitutional manner. He sits on that board.
And is fighting the unconstitutional manner.
Yeah, right. There was no evidence that there was any kind of rampant voter fraud that could have been remedied by any kind of ID when they passed the bill. Wendy Davis, it was one of the things that was put out there. When, before the Shelby versus Alabama case, when there was some question about it, that voter ID was held unconstitutional by a court in D.C. I've yet to hear a good bit of evidence that requiring people to have IDs is going to stop voter fraud. I could think of a lot less intrusive ways. And to me, the party, and again, I saw one of the candidates for Attorney General was going to have a voter fraud task force. Well, look, all that's happening right now is this: they're setting barriers up and they're stepping on the line more and more in different states to prevent, and it's again usually the most vulnerable, the poorest, the least educated.
The likely Democratic?
To me, whether it's likely or
not. But not entirely.
Not entirely. And the day my party starts putting up barriers to keep people from voting or they ask me to do that, I won't do it if it's good for me legally. But we should allow everybody to vote. We should make it easier for everybody to vote. We should set up, and again, the polling places, the times, the ways we can do it should encourage voter participation, period. And I don't see that from my Republican counterparts. I see the opposite, and that should be changed.
So you have what we would consider, let's say, the public interest in voter freedom, voter opportunity, the voter's right not to have to stand for an unreasonable time in a polling line, all of these things, access, time.
Absolutely.
So at what point does the Attorney General have discretion that would impact this?
Well, I mean,
there are some that are obvious and there are some.
Yeah, and right now, of course, the Attorney General's in the middle of a lawsuit it gets way wonky if you start talking about whether or not after Shelby versus Alabama, you know, the Justice Department, you have to get preclearance or any of those things, which is a problem, and it's going to be a problem. But the Attorney General's office, as they pass more legislation in the future, if it is a Republican, if you see further barriers, the Attorney General's office, again, might be asked to write an opinion about whether that's constitutional. The Attorney General's office would have the discretion to determine whether or not the proposed legislation meets federal constitutional muster. The Attorney General's office would decide what resources to put into such a lawsuit if it was not justified. And, you know, again, if it was me and I'm the Attorney General right now, my question would be is why can't the legislature pass less restrictive means of stopping voter fraud? I'll go on record right now. I don't want any voter fraud. I don't want there to be any voter fraud.
Voter fraud isn't as big a problem as election fraud.
Show me evidence of voter fraud, and I'll t- Taylor something. Absent evidence, don't pass legislation that stops voting.
I think election fraud is a bigger problem than voter fraud.
That's, you know, and again, I don't remember. And again, you get accused of all kind of things. But as I recall, when they asked for evidence of this voter fraud, they found like one voter in the Woodlands who
over
was a
years.
Republican. Yes.
Over years.
And then, and at the same time, we're making people have IDs at the polls. You can, you know, write-ins, mail ballots, there's no requirement of IDs, as I recall. And so...
I'm sorry, I'm going to do a quick ID because I'm a little late. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. My guest is Democratic Attorney General nominee Sam Houston, no relation to the historical Sam, and he is going to be on the general election ballot in November. The phone number, we still have some time if you want to call in and ask Sam a question, 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. KPFT. So, actually, what I was going to say was this: when you were talking about IDs, our house burned down during Hurricane Ike, and we literally—this is one of those things—literally got out with the clothes on our backs, 1:30 in the morning. And of course, one of the things you have to do then is you have to prove your ID to get a new driver's license, to get a new Social Security card, and on and on and on. This was not easy.
Nope.
This was a very difficult, frustrating, time-consuming enterprise to have to replace the ID. And when you start to think about that, and then you have people who maybe don't have cars, so they don't have driver's licenses, maybe older people who don't have birth certificates, or maybe the county courthouse got burned down and you can't get that identification anymore, and it's not enough anymore to have a bank account, to have a utilities account, to have maybe, you know, just proof that you live here. And those are the insidious ways that poor people are denied the right to vote. It's hard, it's expensive, it's time-consuming,
it's
frustrating.
There's not a DPS office in many cities. I think Chad Dunn was giving a speech about that, and it's interesting. They did a study on how close the DPS offices are to a lot of voters, and without transportation... it's a barrier.
I live near Ella and 610, and the closest DPS office, which was closed for a very long time, is at 290 in Mangum, and I have to tell you, that would be a heck of a long walk, and that's not far. So, yeah, this gets very complicated. We have Bob on the line. Bob, you're on the air with Sam Houston and myself, and I think we'll get to you in just a moment. Okay, while we're waiting for Egberto to... plug you through. Education. How does the attorney... Hold on. Okay. Bob, you are now on the air. How are you
Good.
Doing tonight?
I've got a question concerning child support, the money. And it seems that nobody really has wanted to touch this since the passage of the Welfare Reform Act of 1997. Barry Smitherman touched it, and he got rebuked by Greg Abbott. And it concerns me that the state's attorney generals are, for federal kickback dollars, imposing monetary child support on one parent. But there's nothing about that that's equal. There's nothing about that that respects the child's right to access to each and both parents on an equal basis.
Yeah, they're considered separate issues, child support and parent access. Yeah. They're disconnected.
And so, to me, it's unethical that a state attorney general would, go out and find a parent to lasso and it just... feels like extortion to me to saddle them with financial responsibilities, and then on top of it all, they don't even see to it that parent has any kind of future access, and sometimes parental alienation is a result where one parent will badmouth the other parent and through the child, and the child learns to hate that other parent.
Bob, I appreciate your comment. I'm going to let Sam answer you on the line because I have
Good. One
more caller
appreciate
I want to take. Okay, Sam, thoughts on child support, visitation, the disconnection between the two in the eyes of the state?
You know, one of the things that, again, it's on my website, I think probably, though, the current attorney general does tout, you know, record numbers of, there's something they'll put up, the record numbers of dollars that they've gained. Well, there's a lot of different things about that, about whether or not they really are getting that amount, whether interest is being calculated correctly. The caller brings up an interesting question. Again, it's pretty complicated to go into all the details, but
25 words or less, how you feel about it and what you might do as attorney general?
I would focus more time on it rather than focusing time on suing the federal government. I think that needs to be looked at.
Okay, fair enough. Andrew, you're on the air with Sam Houston. How you doing tonight?
Yes, hello, Gary. How are y'all doing?
Good, thank you. So great. What's on your mind?
Just a real quick point, if you want proof on voter fraud, just check YouTube. There's plenty of examples on there. But
plenty of examples of voter fraud or non-voter fraud?
Voter fraud about not, you know, voting for other people, not having the correct ID and whatnot.
Okay.
But the point I really wanted to touch on was drug testing welfare recipients over drug testing job applicants, and why I have to take a urine sample to get a job, and if I want to collect unemployment or welfare or whatnot, I don't have to give a urine sample. I can sit on my butt and smoke drugs all day if I wanted, and
allegedly.
I don't feel like that's right, and I just wanted to know how you feel about that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew. Sam,
yes, sir, thank you.
You know, thoughts? And that's a valid point, but here's what I would look at. It's a valid question, and I get it. And but what I would look into is, again, are the dollars spent to drug test everybody in welfare, is that really weeding people out, and is it doing
any good?
The Florida
example says no.
And that would be a concern. I don't want to spend more of my tax money chasing after people if it's not really going to help.
That tax money is then going to go to somebody who doesn't want to look for a job and doesn't care to look for a job, and
it's a
continued source of your tax dollars, whereas one and done, you can use your tax dollars to get them out of the system.
We have to go in just a minute, but I will just, and thank you for calling, Andrew. I will just respond to that very quickly. The Florida example is that the number of drug-using welfare recipients did not begin to justify the cost of drug testing. It turned out to be a money-losing proposition for Florida. Also, when you're talking about drug testing for a job, well, there's private enterprise for you. They're not regulated by the government in that regard, and if they want you to be drug-free and you want that job, you're drug-free. I want to thank my guest, Sam Houston.
I just need to look at it. I mean,
okay.
I think it just needs to be studied a little more.
I want to thank my guest, Sam Houston, the Democratic nominee for Attorney General in the general election in November. Thank you so much. You've been a lot of fun to have, and I thank the callers. They've made some really interesting points and asked some good questions, and I think it's made it a better show. I will see you next week, and since I've already done the 99% thing, I will say slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea. It's the friggin' law. Good night.
Thank you.
Jumpstart your weekend and get your groove on with the region's finest musicians at Discovery Green during the Thursday Concert Series presented by UHD. Enjoy free concerts showcasing dynamic entertainers from Texas and the Gulf Coast. Thursday Concerts at Discovery Green are co-sponsored by 90.1 KPFT-FM. The Spring 2014 Series headliners include Archie Bell, Barbara Lynn, Little Joe E. La Familia, The Cashmere Stage Band, Bill Kirchen, Quiet Company, Skyrocket, and many more dynamic bands. Concerts begin at 6:30 every Thursday night. Most street parking is free starting at 6 p.m. Picnics, blankets, lawn chairs, and dogs are welcome, but glass containers and alcohol are prohibited. Food, wine, and beer are available for purchase from the lake house. A special lake house tent will also be set up to sell fresh grilled tacos, corn, and other tasty bites. For more details on the Discovery Green Thursday Concert Series, visit discoverygreen.com. This is KPFT Houston.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up, and each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible, and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston Eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpfthouston.
The following program may contain language or image.